You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7 o'clock, it's Reveal. Investigators dig up an unidentified murder victim 45 years after she was buried in an attempt to give her back her name. This leads to a series of unexpected revelations about who she was and why she may have been killed. Her case speaks to the complexity and importance of opening up cold cases. That's tonight after 7 o'clock on Reveal on the Ideas Network.
First, a Madison High School student is facing criminal charges after she got into an altercation at school over a week ago. 17-year-old Ariana Connors was in a fight that police say involved several other students. She was arrested on a tentative charge of physical abuse to a child.
The charges against Connors has some community members outraged. In a press conference in front of the Dane County Courthouse last week, groups like the Focused Interruption Coalition called the charges excessive and unnecessary.
They also called for the removal of Education Resource Officers, or EROs, who are police officers based inside schools. People who oppose having EROs have often argued that it leads to disciplinary issues being managed by law enforcement.
Joining us now to tell us more about the controversy around Connor's arrest is Khalif Mouabel. He is the executive director of Breaking Barriers Mentoring and a public speaker on racial justice and mass incarceration in Madison. Khalif, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Jason Nance is also with us. He's an associate professor of law and has written about police officers in schools. He's also the associate director for education law and policy at the Center on Children and Families at the University of Florida. Jason, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Khalif, let's start with you and to focus here for a moment on Ariana Connors' case. Why do you think Connors' case was mismanaged?
There's a lot of underlying factors that that leads us to that. I know the Focus Interruption Coalition, who I'm one of the leaders of the Focus Interruption Coalition, this case came to us early on. And we were just really outraged at the whole setup. And we were, the first thing came to my mind was the school-to-prison pipeline and the mismanagement of these juveniles being treated poorly like adults. And that just didn't sit with us well. First and foremost, Ariana is an avid top student. Not that makes much of a difference as to whether or not she is now or wasn't. The treatment is still the primary factor. But the thing is that she has a whole bright future ahead of her. The ERO that was said to make these charges was also one of the people who was one of the relatives of one of the girls that were involved in this fight. So there's a clear conflict of interest right there. I think her niece was involved. The ERO's niece was involved in this particular altercation. The other thing is that the 16-year-old that Ariana was defending herself against, Ariana was attacked. And the girl that she was defending herself against also received a lot of different charges in juvenile court, of course. But she was charged with assaulting an officer and all kind of other charges, battery, a lot of different charges for juvenile court. And my thing is this. When we talk about EROs, there's absolutely, in a day that we live in now, where there are evidence-based practices, this is the big thing. If you want to get funding for a program, the first thing they want to know is where is the evidence that this thing could possibly work? And even if you can't prove that it works, is there any kind of study that can show that it has potential to work? EROs has quite the opposition. It's quite to the contrary, because it's been proven that the EROs in the school doesn't work. In addition to that, there is no specific benefit for the EROs in the schools. And the police being targeted, they target us in our communities, in the black community. We're targeted. They are occupying forces in our communities. And when we have these same occupying forces in high schools occupying that space, it creates a tension between our young black babies and those police. And so there is a clear recipe for disengagement. And when you think about disengagement, there are other things that they're going to engage in. And there's also going to create that tension and that resistance and all of that, that's going to impact that environment in ways that sets it up for the school to prison pipeline.
Jason, you study EROs, these police officers in schools. What does your data tell you?
Well, I conducted an empirical study that was published in the Washington University Law Review in 2016, and I analyzed restricted data from the U.S. Department of Education, specifically the School Survey on Crime and Safety, and I was able to get access to a restricted version. And essentially what I did is I examined what effect of having having regular contact with an ERO has on the odds of referring students to law enforcement for committing certain offenses at school. And what I found is that even after controlling for things like school disorder or crime at school, neighborhood crime, reporting requirements that mandate that students be sent to law enforcement for committing certain offenses, as well as other school characteristic and student demographic variables. And I found that having a regular contact with an SRO was predictive of greater odds of referring students to law enforcement for all types of offenses, and that includes higher level offenses such as physical attacks with a weapon or threats with a weapon. But even more concerningly, it was also predictive of greater odds of referring students to law enforcement for lower level offenses such as what happened in this case, a fight, vandalism, maybe a threat without a weapon. And that's particularly concerning to me.
Yeah. We're talking right now with Khalif Moab El. He's the executive director of Breaking Barriers Mentoring and a public speaker on racial justice and mass incarceration. Also with us, Jason Nance, associate professor of law, and who has been writing about having police officers in schools. He is at the University of Florida. They're joining us to talk about the role of EROs in schools, and also Khalif has been addressing a recent case of Ariana Connor, who was she had an altercation in the lunchroom and then basically was arrested and charged for a series of crimes.
Yeah. So there are even greater issues here as it pertains to EROs in schools. I know that it's really easy for the school to call the police if there was a existing need for law enforcement to be present there on the scene. They could come within 5 minutes. That's number one. Number two, we're talking about $400,000 that's being gutted from the educational budget. And we're talking about schools that are already under-resourced, underserved, and that has very little diversity in the schools as well. So Without there being a need for these occupying forces to be there, I mean it's poor spending, it's a misappropriation in my opinion of taxpayers' dollars, and what are we really doing? What kind of message are we really sending to children? I mean, as far as the likelihood of success, I mean I don't know what kind of message that sends, because if you're thinking police. The communities that I come from, when I think police, somebody did something wrong. So if I see police on corners, they're saying that this is a bad neighborhood. This is a bad environment. And if I see that force every single day, at some point, I'm going to have contact with that force. I mean, subconsciously, I'm already having contact with that occupying force. Every single time I wake up and walk out of my house, I see that police or police officers in general. And it doesn't create a feeling of ease for me. It creates tension. It creates anxiety. It creates all of those things that make me feel displaced. And so when you have that same kind of you leave the community with being faced with, I'm living in a bad environment. The odds are stacked against me. And then you go into a school and those same things are reaffirmed for you. I just think that that's just classic for failure for our children. And I mean, we have a demographic of teachers. It's about 75% or a little bit less than 75% of those teachers are white women. And we have very little diversity. If we do have diversity, the diversity is very limited. We have very little cultural competency, very little training exercises to really engage our children of color and that kind of thing. And we're wasting money on EROs, occupying forces in school, instead of trying to find ways to enrich the potential likelihood of success for our children. I just think that those values are backwards.
So, Jason, what does the data say about the relationship between EROs and students of color?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. What we've seen is that, just as Khalif was describing, is that EROs many times are not very well equipped to interact with students that are different from them. So, for example, students with disabilities, minority students, maybe LGBTQ students, they don't receive very much training regarding how to de-escalate and how to appropriately interact with these individuals. What is, I think, concerning is that because of the lack of training, you can see how they handle situations that I think should be handled differently. So, for example, in its investigation of Ferguson, Missouri, the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department, the U.S. Department of Justice, they determined the following, that they determined that, this is a quote from their statement, that SRO's propensity for arresting students demonstrates the lack of understanding of the negative consequences associated with such arrests. For example, they told the Department of Justice they were proud of their arrest rate. They viewed that as a positive result of their work. And so this shows a lack of training and a lack of understanding regarding the very negative consequences associated with involving a student in the justice system.
I remember in my high school there was an ERO, and I'm going to date myself, but this is back in the 80s, early 90s, but this was a plainclothes police officer. It wasn't someone in uniform. Does that matter at all, Jason, whether the person is wearing a uniform or not?
I'm not sure if it matters, or I think that it would matter if the students are aware of the police officer being there and the purpose for the police officer. I think that tends to matter more. Khalif was talking about some of the, you know, positive things and the negative things associated with having it. I view this as sort of a cost-benefit analysis, and what they're wearing I don't think makes as much of a difference. Maybe they're trying to blend in a little bit more, but the communities and the schools would say, okay, we're trying to build relationships of trust with the students, we're trying to make campuses safer. But as Khalif was explaining, is that trust can be damaged, I think, many times as police officers continue to mishandle these events. And there's questions regarding whether or not having a police officer there on campus actually creates a safer environment. So the positives are in question. And then we have a lot of negative things, as Khalif was mentioning. They're very expensive, that they contribute to this very intense surveillance environment that damages trust. And now we have more students that are being involved in the justice system. And so, like Khalif, I think that the negatives do outweigh the positives in many instances, no matter what, you know, they choose to wear.
We're talking about a controversy in Wisconsin after a Madison High School student was arrested and is facing criminal charges for getting into a fight in the school lunchroom. And we're hearing from Khalif Mouab-El, a speaker on mass incarceration and racial justice issues in Madison, and Jason Nance, an associate professor of law who studies police presence in schools.
And you can tell us what you think by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you agree with our guest? Do you think students should face criminal charges for fighting in schools? Is having school police officers or EROs good for students? Why? Or maybe why not? And if you work in the justice system or in the schools, we'd love to hear from you. Call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing the conversation about police in schools with Khalif Mouab-El and Jason Nance. Khalif is a public speaker on racial justice and mass incarceration issues based in Madison. And Jason is an associate professor of law at the University of Florida, and he's written about the impact of school police officers, or EROs.
And you can tell us what you think by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of having school police officers or EROs? Do you think the presence of law enforcement in schools has a disproportionate effect on communities of color? And if you have kids in school or remember your own school days, tell us whether or not you would want law enforcement involved in the case on a fight. Call 800-642-1234.
And let's take a call right away. Let's go to Sandra in Elkhorn. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to add?
Well, when I was going to high school, we had the officers in plain clothes, and, you know, we did have a bunch of altercations that happened at our school. But the reason why I agree that we should have these officers in there, because it's not the lack of, you know, with the presence of the police officer, it's how parents are taking care of their kids. They are so relaxed on taking care of their kids that kids don't have respect for their elders anymore. And the reason why I say that is because my aunts, I've got several aunts that work in the school district, and I had one of my aunts end up getting several broken ribs and a broken jaw because a student got upset that somebody took his pen. And my aunt tried calming him down, and the next thing my aunt knows is this kid gets pissed off, and he turns around and he hurt my aunt. I've dealt with situations where you see these kids that are getting violent. Look at the YouTube videos that show these kids are going after teachers, disrespecting them, yelling at them, causing these, you know, big altercations by throwing stuff. And a lot of the, like, seniors in high schools, these boys, you know, throw their weight around. And without these officers there, they're there to protect not only the students but the staff as well. I mean, it's not just the violent issues, but these officers are there to help kids if they have a minor thing. There are so many girls that have been assaulted by other students, or they're, you know, unsure what's going on, or they come, you know, other kids come and say, hey, this is a concern I have, one about my friends. You know, is there any way you guys can look into this?
So I see what Sandra is saying. She, you know, has a very personal experience as well. And Khalif, how would you react to that and disrespect for elders?
Well, number one, I think a lot of these issues stem from parents not being able to maintain their households. But when we're talking about parents not being able to maintain their households, we're looking at punitive alternatives for these parents. But these are parents who live in single parent households, work 2 to 3 jobs to take care of 5 or 6 children. And we're talking about an impoverished environment where these children are coming from. The Supreme Court has already stated that it takes about studies have shown that it takes about 25 years for a person to mature adequately. And that means that they at that point that they develop some kind of a culpable state of mind where they're able to appreciate the wrongfulness of their behavior. So right now we're criminalizing people. It's almost like criminalizing people that have mental illnesses. That's number one. Number two, I went to prison at 15 years old, and the presence of the police in my school caused me to drop out. And that caused me to become disconnected. That's number two. Number three, when we're talking about the issues around not being able to maintain and control the environment, you have school security that can do that. There are other alternatives to policing that could be employed inside of the school that could also minimize the environmental disruptions and things of that nature.
And Jason, and I'm going to step in there, you have actually argued that exact thing, that schools should learn to handle certain issues without the justice system. Why is that?
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's a couple of things here. I think that following the tragedies that occurred at Columbine, the U.S. Department of Education, the U.S. Secret Service, they investigated 37 incidents of violence in schools from 1974 to 2000. So they were, you know, very steeped in this. And they concluded the following. They concluded that in safe schools, this is what constitutes a safe school. It's where you have adults and students that respect each other, where you have positive personal role models in the faculty, you have places of open discussion where diversity and differences can be respected, where you have communication between adults and students that's encouraged, that conflict is managed and mediated constructively. Then you have another study that was conducted by Matthew Steinberg and his associates within the Chicago public school system, which also has had trouble as well. And they found that even in schools serving high concentrations of students, from high poverty and crime areas, that it was the quality of relationships between staff and students and between staff and parents that most strongly define safe schools. And so what I would argue is that by putting the police officers in schools, I think that that's the wrong solution, that's not what really creates safe environments. What creates safe environments are where you have positive school climates. And there are many different initiatives out there, evidence-based initiatives that work very well, that we've seen a lot of promise. Things such as restorative justice initiatives, things like social and emotional learning, things like positive behaviors, interventions, and supports. All of those different programs and initiatives create more positive school climates and environments in which students and teachers and students learn to trust one another better. They have better relationships, and that's what we find is really creating safe school environments, not the police officers, not the metal detectors.
Sandra, thanks so much for your call. Let's try to get one more call in here. Steve in Slinger. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Yeah, what would you like to add very quickly?
Yes, I am. I grew up in Milwaukee and went to MPS, and we had police in our school, and it made me feel safer because I was a skinny little white kid. I got pushed around a lot and beat up and chased home every day from school.
Cleef, really quickly, the takeaway here?
I grew up in Milwaukee, so I think Milwaukee is a different situation than Madison. The crime rates in Milwaukee in comparison to the crime rate in here in Madison, I think there's no comparison. That's number one there. But my thing is this, is that we're setting up predominantly children of color to have an early meet with the system. And I think anybody that has a moral conscience or any kind of moral rectitude would see that children don't belong in prison, and we don't need to be setting children up for failure and to have those brushes with the system.
Cleef and Jason, thank you so much for joining us today. That was Cleef Mouab-El, Executive Director of Breaking Barriers Mentoring, and Jason Nance, an Associate Professor of Law at the University of Florida.
This is Central Time.